Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, why the rapid rise of AI makes rural broadband all the more essential. The backstory on Native American land acknowledgement statements in theater playbills. A Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame inductee whose children's books have sold more than 47 million copies. For budding authors, the many coming literary events from the James Baker Hall Foundation, and a play based on the story of Ruth Hunt Candies. First, education contributor Bridget Blom and her guests take a closer look at the intersection of artificial intelligence, rural internet access, and the future of education in Kentucky.
As AI rapidly reshapes how we learn and work, access to reliable broadband has become critical for opportunity, particularly in rural communities across the Commonwealth. To help us unpack what this means for Kentucky's students, educators, and employers, I'm joined by Dr. Lisa Blue, Director of Artificial Intelligence Strategies at the Office of Artificial Intelligence Strategies, Innovation, and Success at Eastern Kentucky University. Dr. Blue works at the forefront of integrating AI into higher education and workforce initiatives. She's here to talk about both the promise and the challenges facing rural Kentucky as this technology continues to evolve. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Blue.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are having a conversation today about the intersection between high-speed internet, broadband, and AI. Folks might think of those things as distinct. We've talked about the broadband access issue many times and for many years, especially as we experienced COVID and realized that the internet was critical, imperative, a prerequisite for remote learning, remote access to work, and remote access to healthcare. Now, at the advent of AI, beyond the advent of AI, we're recognizing that the future of learning grounded in an artificially intelligent world requires broadband. Kentucky's currently in the bottom 10 in the country for broadband access. Still 90% and above of Kentuckians have access to the internet, but there are some folks who do not. And our schools, if the internet is interrupted, that can interrupt learning. So before we even get into AI, broadband, high-speed internet, it's not just nice to have, it's a must-have.
It is absolutely a must-have. If our students don't have access to those AI tools and other learning tools afforded to us on the internet, then they're going to fall behind.
You know, so many of us still think about books in the classroom, pencil and paper, maybe computers, but still reliance on paper products. And that just isn't the case in classrooms.
No, not at all. Even with publishers, I'm seeing this move towards online interactive textbooks, because we know that when students can interact with the material, they're going to retain the information much better. And so the day of paper and pencil and print books is really falling behind.
And that's kind of the opposite for those of us on the early side of the digital divide or the other side of the digital divide, where our brains still engage with paper products. But what I'm hearing you say is for younger learners, they actually learn better with digital material.
I wouldn't say that they learn better with digital material. They learn better in an active learning environment. And so these online textbooks, when done well, offer these active learning opportunities that we can't offer with print textbooks.
As we think about then those online tools, active learning, AI is part of all of that.
Absolutely.
I think I've heard you say it's ubiquitous.
Yes.
Those of us who don't even think we're interacting with AI on a regular basis, in fact, are.
Yes. And that's really where we need to start, is with basic AI literacy. AI literacy is really understanding what AI is, roughly how it works, where it shows up, and what its limits are. And our students may not think they're using AI because they never open a standalone AI tool, but AI may already be shaping the search results that they see, the writing suggestions in their emails, or the videos a platform serves up next. AI literacy really starts with recognizing that these systems are already a part of our daily lives.
So as a student in the classroom, mm-hmm. teachers today helping students with AI literacy, online literacy, critical thinking, what are the things that students and teachers need to be aware of as they're using these tools?
They need to have a basic grasp of that AI literacy, but we also need to start developing with our students tool literacy. Tool literacy means knowing that different AI systems will do different jobs well, and that using the wrong tool for the task often leads to poor results. A lot of bad AI output comes from asking a system to do something that it was never meant to do, like retrieving facts with a browser versus summarizing those facts with the AI summary that comes at the top. So we see that with that example in particular, a system can give you a clean, confident answer to a research question and still be the wrong tool for finding strong sources or checking whether the answer is actually true. That's why tool literacy really matters. Something can sound good and still be wrong.
So just underscoring the importance of the broadband access piece,
sure.
Because these are going to be skills, our students, durable skills, if you will, that our students are going to need to graduate with,
yes.
How they interact with artificial intelligence, how they use it effectively to meet their end goal, to support them to be competitive in an employment environment and do their work well.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because really that points to another durable skill, which is having good communication skills. You may have heard of prompt engineering, and that's basically how we interact with an AI tool. It boils down to having really fine-tuned communication skills. Can you write with clarity to instruct the AI? Can you give enough context for it to do what you're asking it to do? Can you name the constraints, and in doing so, describe what good output looks like? Once you have that output, can you revise it to ensure it's factually accurate, free from bias, and satisfies the goals of the original task? It's all good communication skills, though.
Mm.
And it's really important, too, that rather than letting the tool kind of take over, we've heard a lot of fears around de-skilling, and in the workplace, people are complaining about AI work slop. And I really want to make sure that our students are getting out of this mode of operating with AI that we've seen for the last 3 years, where people have been encouraged to be the human in the loop. The human in the loop mode really says, hey, prompt an AI, look at the output, and just edit that. I heard something back in January during the Davos summit that really struck a chord. Julie Sweet from Accenture said, we need to be the humans in the lead. And I really like that, because that human in the lead means that the person decides from the start whether AI even belongs in the process, then sets the purpose, the guardrails, and the standard for success.
That's a fascinating shift, especially as there's been fear around what an AI future looks like.
Sure.
And the role of humans in that AI future, and to position us clearly in the lead with a powerful tool at our side,
yes,
is much preferred over some of the other ideas of what 100 years from now might look like.
Right. And it's not surprising that we started with fear, because we didn't know what we were dealing with. 3 years in, we have a little bit better feeling for it. And this year in particular, we're seeing a lot of talk about AI agents that can go outside of that app and do actions on behalf of the user. So there's going to be some fear about that as well. But I think it all comes back to being the human in the lead, communicating effectively with the AI, and making sure you're putting in those guardrails and those constraints so that you can work safely with it.
And our students in K-12 education and in higher education building the skills to do just that.
Yes.
So some of the fear also around AI is around something referred to as cognitive offloading.
Yes.
De-skilling. Mm-hmm. How do we manage against cognitive offloading and de-skilling?
Cognitive offloading has been a problem for forever. When the internet came along, you know, it's going to destroy higher education because students can just go on the internet and find what they need. Not true. We had the same argument with graphing calculators, general calculators in the beginning. Students aren't going to learn how to do math because they've got these tools that do it for them. It's disruptive in the beginning until we figure out how to assimilate this new tool into the learning landscape, and then we learn how to use it effectively to do more than we were able to do previously. AI is going to be the same.
So foundational learning is still essential.
Absolutely.
So, of course, reading, writing, mathematics.
Yes.
Those foundational skills that allow us to use the tools at a higher level.
Yes, because you still have to be a subject matter expert to be able to look at the output and say, is this really meeting the goals of what I was trying to accomplish? And that's why I always tell students and faculty and staff, don't start prompting the AI with random trivia questions. Prompt it to give you output where you're the subject matter expert so you can judge the quality of the output. And it's important to start in that arena and understand how the AI works and where it tends to trip up so that whenever you do start pushing the boundaries of what you know which tool to choose for the job, and you can judge whether that output is quality output or not.
So, Lisa, as you advise higher ed leaders at Eastern Kentucky University, and think about advising others as they are calling on your expertise.
Sure.
What do you say to school principals, superintendents right now as they're figuring out how to navigate a world that is not natural for them?
Right. It's tough because you have to find those people in your organization who are spending the time learning how to use the AI effectively and who can communicate that knowledge to other individuals. And there is so much to learn, it can be daunting. That's why I spend so much of my time trying to help others navigate this landscape. Where do you start? How do you use this effectively? How do you guide others to use it effectively? The main thing is to get in there and just start playing with it.
You mentioned that EKU has recently adopted a policy for AI use. I think many of our other higher education institutions have as well.
Yes.
What guidance do you give leaders thinking about policy guardrails for AI?
I think it really benefits everyone tremendously to have some sort of an institution level AI use in the workplace policy, because then that helps everybody understand what the safeguard rails are to work within, and then we can build our workflows in those safeguard rails. And other universities I've worked with that don't have that institutional level AI policy are left trying to figure it out in their disparate units, and it's really a struggle that they shouldn't have to take on. I think it's really helpful to have a larger framework, and then you can fine-tune it for the discipline-specific, the course-specific, the instructor's preferences, and go from there.
And for leaders to open themselves up to the expertise in their midst, and surely EKU is doing that with you as well.
Sure.
I think also the struggle that maybe families, students are having thinking about their future and the future of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
You are someone who has followed a winding path, so to speak, in your career, not intending to move into expertise in artificial intelligence, but found your way there through all sorts of different ways of thinking about systems, maybe. If you were to say something to your younger self, your high school self, what would you say to that high school self about being ready for the future?
Oh, absolutely. I would tell my high school self to stay curious. That's the most important asset to have. Remain curious, and then also look to the adjacent possible. Interesting work often starts where a new capability meets an old problem that has not been solved well.
Wow. So bringing all of our lived experience, book experience, traditional experience, and not so traditional experience to bear to solve the problems of the future.
Absolutely.
So we'll bring it back to broadband. Really thinking about Kentucky and rural parts of Kentucky, that broadband is essential, that we get broadband right.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the bottom 10 of the country, 90% plus individuals have access to high-speed internet, but that still leaves a gap. We've got to get that right as a state.
I agree.
If we were to not get that right, absence of high-speed internet and broadband, what is the cautionary tale?
Well,
that you would give?
If students cannot get reliable access, they cannot build reliable AI skills. It's not a, I played with it once and I'm done. I know all I need to know. In an AI-shaped world, uneven access becomes uneven opportunity. And this is about standing up for students to make sure they have the access, the knowledge, and the judgment to build a better future than the one we inherited.
Lisa, as you think about our future, artificial intelligence, curiosity clearly in your core, what gives you hope for that future?
I have hope that we can solve some of the problems that have plagued us for a very long time using this new powerful tool to co-create the solutions we've needed.
Lisa Blue, Director of Artificial Intelligence Strategies at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When you go to a Lexington Theater Company production and thumb through the program, you'll come across an eye-catching statement. It's titled Land Acknowledgement. And it says, quote, "The Lexington Theater Company acknowledges that the area we occupy, now called Kentucky, is the homeland of more than 20 indigenous tribes, including the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Shawnee, Adena, Hopewell, and Osage peoples. We pay our respect and honor their heritage as we create and share our productions on the ancestral land. We celebrate their rich and beautiful traditions of storytelling, dance, and song, and we hope to honor those traditions with our performance tonight," end quote. Land acknowledgments are gaining ground as a meaningful gesture of respect and recognition. We wanted to know more about this. Joining us here in the studio is Lindy Franklin Smith, co-founder and artistic director of the Lexington Theater Company. Welcome, Lindy.
Hello, Tom. It's always so good to be with you.
And on Zoom, Trevor McChristian. He's a member of Lexington Theater Company's Inclusivity Advisory Council and himself Native American. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having us.
Lindy, first of all, let's come to you. What inspired you to place this recognition in Lexington Theater Company programs?
Well, Tom, you know, back in 2020, 2021, we had a big initiative at the Lex, and that was creating our Inclusivity Advisory Collective. And from the beginning of the company, we've always had a spirit of belonging, but we wanted to see what we could do to advance that, what we could do to do more in that space of making sure that everybody feels welcomed and included in our spaces. And so we gathered together an incredible group of creatives representing lots of different communities and lots of different kinds of artists. And we basically got around a table, but it wasn't a table, it was a Zoom room, for many, many months and came up with all kinds of initiatives that we wanted to put into place at the Lexington Theater Company. And among them was this land acknowledgement and having Trevor McChristian, who is an alum of the Lex. You would have seen him in our productions of The Music Man as Tommy Gelis, or he was Al in our Chorus Line, and he was Riff in our West Side Story. And Trevor, being Native American, was also wonderfully generous to work with me on crafting this land acknowledgement. And it's been a beautiful partnership together, putting it into practice.
All right. Well, let's bring Trevor into this. Trevor, the statement that appears in the Lexington Theater Company program lists the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Shawnee, Adena, Hopewell, and Osage tribes. Each one had a presence in what became Kentucky. First of all, are you a member of one of these groups?
Well, I myself am not a member of any of those tribal affiliations. I'm actually an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation, mm-hmm. But I do have deep ties to Lindy and Jeremy here at the Lex. Like she said, I've actually at this point in my life have known them longer than I have not, which is how I got involved here and just involved and engaged with the Lex as a whole. But I am happy to represent and advocate just in general for Indigenous peoples here at the Lex, with the understanding that tribal communities themselves are not monolithic. We do not look or think or act or even feel the same about pretty much anything. Obviously, there are different intersections of these thoughts and feelings and opinions about things, but based on where we are currently at in what I like to refer to and what is generally referred to as Indian country, it's not Indian, I-N-D-I-A-N, but Indian as in the and the letters. In terms of how we feel and where we're currently at in Indian country, I do feel comfortable advising the Lex in this capacity.
So this land acknowledgement, why is it important to make this statement?
I think it's important to remember where we are as a current culture in American society and where we come from historically. Indigenous peoples have been here for centuries on Turtle Island. And I think advocating and acknowledging that is incredibly important in terms of a storytelling perspective. Would love for Lindy to share a little bit about that as well in terms of her role here at the Lex.
Yeah, if you could do that, Lindy.
Of course. Well, here at the Lex, we tell stories. And stories are how we make meaning as human. And so it feels only appropriate and respectful to honor and to pay our respects to the people who were the first storytellers on this land. And, you know, when Trevor and I worked together on the language for the land acknowledgement, we really wanted to be specific about mentioning the fact that we hope in our own way we're carrying on that tradition by continuing to tell stories, by continuing to sing and continuing to dance, and by acknowledging our Native Americans, by acknowledging Indigenous peoples in our program, our hope is that not only are we sort of paying honor and paying respect, but we hope that people feel seen and people feel included. And that's all part of this inclusivity advisory collective that we have. The idea behind it is we just want everyone to feel welcome and we want everyone to feel a part. And so perhaps just reading that statement in the program might make someone feel like they're even more a part of what we're doing at the Lexington Theater Company. And that's what we're going for.
My understanding is that a land acknowledgement is not just about the physical place, the land itself. It's also about the people and the rituals that took place on that land. Do you hope that this inspires conversation around that?
I think so. You know, Trevor and I were actually just talking about this the other day, and he mentioned something that he can probably say more eloquently than me. But, you know, he was saying, you know, if just one person happens upon that land acknowledgement and it spurs them on to learn more. It spurs them on to maybe do some more research or get in touch with some of the other wonderful organizations here in Kentucky that are advocating and promoting Indigenous respect and history. And I think if that's one thing that we can do, that's important to us. I think one of the things that I want to make sure is comes clearly across in this interview is that we by no means feel like we are leading the charge. We feel like we are learning and growing right along with everybody else. But if our effort just to be a part of inclusion, help somebody else to also feel included or to go on their own journey of understanding more about people who are different from them, then we feel like we're contributing in some way.
Have you heard from anybody who's come across a statement in a program?
You know, Tom, I have to say, you're the first one to really reach out to me and say, hey, this is cool. But I'm hopeful that even though we haven't gotten specific feedback, that people are noticing. And I think actually, you know, now that I think about it, maybe one or two other people mentioned something and said, hey, this is really cool. I'm glad you're doing this. But this is the first big, meaningful public conversation we've had about it. So it's exciting.
Trevor, this one's for you. Is there more of an Indigenous presence in American theater than we may realize?
Yes, definitely. So interestingly enough, I'm actually currently doing the third production of a Rolling World premiere of a play that's called Haunted by Seminole and Muskogee writer Tara Moses. Additionally, just this week, it was announced that a 9-person Native play called Feast for the Dead by Wyandotte writer and creator Maddie Easley is about to get an off-Broadway premiere in New York City at the Soho Rep Theater. In addition, in 2022, Mohegan multi-hyphenate creator Madeline Sayet premiered her one-woman show Where We Belong at the Public Theater in New York. And I just generally feel that Natives, in terms of the theater industry as a whole, are kind of at the precipice of a very large changing tide. I think everyone in the American theater is about to witness some cultural shifts in the industry, largely for the better. Native actors and creators actually make up less than 1% of the entire industry as a whole. So being able to represent that 1% and advocate for that 1% is critical when we have incredible actors, directors, designers, writers that all encompass a bunch of different tribes throughout the entirety of Turtle Island as a whole.
Well, the productions that you just named, you just listed, to me,
sound like windows into these various cultures that have not been there in the past.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. So interestingly enough, because of all of the different complexities, like I said earlier, tribes are not monolithic. So when you have all of these different writers, Wyandot, Muscogee, Seminole, I had mentioned previously, I'm from the Navajo Nation. You have all of these perspectives being brought to the table, and we are able to kind of connect and share all of these different elements about storytelling with one another. And a lot of these stories are semi-autobiographical, but then there's also some of these stories that are incredibly farcical or comedies in a lot of these ways with deeper meanings once you actually sort of unpack the layers of the writing at hand.
Trevor, for those of us who are not Native American, don't trace our ancestry to a Native American heritage, but want to support recognition of the indigenous presence on this continent prior to the arrival of white Europeans. And we want to be allies. What does it mean to be a good indigenous ally?
A great question. I think that a lot of people will give you a lot of different answers in regards to being a solid indigenous ally. But for me, I think something that's critically important to remember is that Native people are often referred to as the invisible minority in America. We are here. We have been here for centuries, and we will continue to be here for centuries further. I think being a strong indigenous ally means actively listening to Natives in the space and following their leadership. This conversation, yes, pertains to theater, but I also think that this can pertain more broadly to things like actively combating the climate crisis, stewardship of the land, respecting tribal sovereignty, and just simply amplifying Indigenous voices as a whole. Many people kind of use the term BIPOC, B-I-P-O-C, which stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. But people frequently use that term in spaces where an Indigenous person is not actually present and contributing to the conversation. Again, it comes back to what I had mentioned earlier, that sort of invisible minority. There are tons of scholars and activists and organizations and more leading the fight for Indigenous justice on many, many, many fronts. And we should really simply just be following their guidance for things like self-education and amplifying their work in all spaces.
Well, Lindy, do you hope to see other local organizations making similar land acknowledgments in some way?
I mean, of course. I think what Trevor just said about being a good listener, I think is really, really important. And that's what we try to do with the Lexington Theater Company. We're always trying to listen and learn and grow and see how we can make a positive impact, whether that's here in Lexington or across the country.
That's Lindy Franklin Smith, co-founder and artistic director of the Lexington Theater Company. Thank you, Lindy.
Of course. Thank you.
And with us on Zoom, Trevor McChristian, a member of the Lexington Theater Company Inclusivity Advisory Council, and himself is Navajo. Thank you so much for joining us, Trevor.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. And coming up, three literary and theater events you might want to be aware of, beginning with this year's Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Here's literary contributor Tom Eblin.
The Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame was created in 2012 by the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning and the Kentucky Arts Council. It's a sort of lifetime achievement award for the state's most accomplished writers. Hall of Fame inductees are chosen by committees of writers and avid readers convened by the Carnegie Center and the Arts Council based on nominations from the public. So far, 71 Kentuckians have been inducted into the Hall of Fame, 22 living writers and 49 from the past. Six more writers will be inducted into the Hall of Fame this month. The ceremony will be at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington on Monday, March 30th, beginning at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public, no ticket required. Perhaps the most familiar name among the inductees is novelist Silas House, a former Kentucky poet laureate and author of many acclaimed novels. He will be joined by another former Kentucky poet laureate, Jeff Worley, and by two of the nation's best-selling authors for children, Marcia Thornton Jones and Debbie Dady. Two deceased authors will also be added to the Hall of Fame, former Kentucky Poet Laureate Fred Smock, and Kentucky historian Lowell Harrison. All of the living inductees plan to be at the ceremony, so if you're a fan of their work, you should be there too. They will be signing books afterward. Today on Eastern Standard, we're speaking with one of this year's Hall of Fame inductees, children's author and teacher Marcia Thornton Jones of Lexington. Marcia has written many books on her own, but the majority of her work has been co-written with Debbie Dady, a former Lexington resident who now lives in New Hampshire. They are among the nation's most successful authors for children, having sold more than 47 million books. Perhaps their most famous books are the Bailey School Kids stories. Marcia, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how you and Debbie became children's book authors.
It started right here in Central Kentucky when we were both teaching at a private school, Sayre Elementary. Debbie, at the time, was the media specialist, and I was teaching computer skills and reading and writing to the kids. Actually, what happened was I had a really bad day, and the kids were misbehaving. They wouldn't pay attention. They wouldn't stay on task. And I told Debbie, what would it take to get their attention? I said, I guess I'd have to grow 10 feet tall, sprout horns, and blow smoke out my nose. And she started to laugh. And she said, that would make a fun story. And so the next day, during our 20-minute teacher lunch break, we sat down and tried to write our story.
And what story did that become?
That was Vampires Don't Wear Polka Dots.
Okay.
It was the first story that would become The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids books.
So what do you think makes a good children's book?
I think it is a story that is relevant to kids, that resonate with them because it's something that they can relate to, and that it is told from a child's perspective, using kid voice, kid descriptions, kid situations, so that when they open the book, they feel like another kid is telling them this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about some of the series that you and Debbie have written, and then some of the books that you have written on your own.
We've written 8 different series together. And some of them are spinoff series to The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids, but we also have Ghostville Elementary, Triplet Trouble, Barkley School for Dogs. So we've done quite a few series. I have written picture books, chapter books, and mid-grade novels.
Well, when you're thinking about a story idea, how do you know when one of your ideas might be a success?
I think it's when we start to laugh and giggle.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's also when something we start reading just really grabs our attention, or it is something that I feel like I'm learning from. I know one of my mid-grade novels, Woodford Brave, I started to write because I wanted to try to understand the differences between courage and cowardice. And so I started to write to understand. I've done the same thing. I've also published adult poetry and adult short stories. And many of those came from me just sitting down thinking, you know, I don't get this. And so I worked it out in my journal. And then the journal pages became either poetry or short stories.
Woodford Brave is a good example. Tell us about that story.
So Woodford Brave actually started with me trying to understand some current events of the time. And it's funny how current events keep recurring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yesterday's current events become 10 years from now, those current events. So, you know, I started seeing this repetition of some things that were going on. And it reminded me back when I was growing up during the Vietnam War. And during that war, it was not uncommon for young men to try to avoid the draft by fleeing to Canada. And my neighbor did that. And I can remember I was young. I was younger than draft age. So I was younger than this young man who took off in the middle of the night, drove away from his home, from everything he knew, and drove in the dead of night to a country he knew nothing about. And I thought, my gosh, that is one of the bravest things I've ever heard. So I was surprised when everybody around me started talking about the cowardice of draft dodgers. And so I sat down and tried to make some sense of that. I was trying to make sense of current events by looking at past events.
Mm-hmm.
And sat down and started writing that story. And then I started talking to my mother, who came of age during World War II. And I thought, look at this. some of the same stuff was going on during World War II. And so I can remember sitting in her den talking about what it was like for her coming of age during World War II. And I furiously took notes, and soon that story became set during World War II. And so it was about a boy trying to figure out the difference between him being afraid and his father being ever so brave by fighting in Europe during World War II, and what that meant for him. And that became Woodford Brave.
What kind of reaction have you gotten, for instance, to that story from readers?
Well, my mother said, "Can you write stuff like this? Is this allowed?" She was my number one critic. She was very surprised at how I could weave her personal stories into a work of fiction. But other than that, I've gotten a lot of good feedback with teachers who wanted to use it with their kids, because it has universal topics to it. And I think that's another thing that makes a solid, successful book, that it has universal themes that can resonate with different generations.
Over the years, have you heard a lot from children who've read your books and wanted to reach out to comment on them or offer story ideas or want to know what happened to characters? Or
Absolutely. That is one of the best things about writing for kids, is getting their letters. And I think that might be the best form of recognition. I really appreciate this honor of being inducted into the Hall of Fame. But when I get a letter from readers, it just really makes me stop. It gives me pause, because I think about these stories that I'm sitting here in my little enclosed space all by myself, and I'm tapping out stories and I'm just creating them. And then if I get a letter from somebody like from Australia, from California, from Europe, from all over the world, I've received letters, and it just makes me realize how powerful writing can be when you get these letters. And I don't know, I haven't written that much for adults, but I tend to think we as authors for children's work have a great deal of power and responsibility to write stories that kids can connect to and learn from while they are also developing their reading skills. And then they also, I think, are more apt to reach out to the author. And I've received so many letters that have just made me stop in my tracks and realize how important it is what we do.
When you're thinking about, you know, not only telling a good story, but that kind of responsibility, how do you use that knowledge to kind of construct a story? You know, I mean, you know, you don't want to moralize or don't want to instruct kids, because kids don't want to be instructed to. But how do you kind of pique their curiosity and maybe teach them things without them knowing it or being heavy-handed with it?
Okay, perfect question. By staying off the page. And that's one of the hardest thing, I think, for adult writers who are working on books intended for children. And that is, you have to stay off the page. It has to be told from the child's perspective. So you have to give the kid characters agency, their own agency. You have to tell it in words, in vocabulary, in the lingo of kids. And again, like what I was saying earlier, you have to set it in kids' situation so that it feels like it is not the adult writer talking to the kids. It's as if they are reading something happening to kids that are just like they are.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. Once again, I've been speaking with children's author Marcia Thornton-Jones, who is one of six great Kentucky writers who will be inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. The ceremony is free and open to the public and will begin at 7 p.m. on Monday, March 30th at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington. Reporting for Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin from the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
With us now is Larry Pemble, who, as managing director, president, and treasurer of the James Baker Hall Foundation, formed in honor of his father, is a man wearing many hats, and all for a good cause, that of supporting and encouraging the care and feeding of Kentucky's literary community. Thanks for joining us, Larry, and I know that you have a busy agenda in the weeks ahead, so let's dive right into that.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom. It's great. We do have a lot going on this spring. We've got several programs running to support Kentucky writers around the state. In particular, we have a book launch coming up. Our 2025 Book Award winner, Willie Davis, will launch his short story collection, Honeysuckle Season, at Joseph Beth on April 4th at 7 p.m.
I know you're also getting ready to start receiving submissions for the 2026 James Baker Hall Book Award. When does that window open and close?
It opens on April 1st, and it will remain open through June 30th. This year, we'll be asking for work of a creative nonfiction genre.
And Larry, what's your sense of the literary landscape in Kentucky in 2026?
I say often these days that I had no idea how vibrant and how alive and active the literary community in Kentucky is. It's amazing to me. Everywhere we go, there are vibrant young writers that are participating in writing groups, and there are people mentoring them and things going on everywhere that we go. We're moving to Hazard and to Berea this year, kind of expanding our geographic scope, and I'm going to Hazard in May.
Is that the Kentucky Writers on the Road program?
That is. We'll take Willie Davis, the winner of the award, and his story is actually based in Hazard. So we took the opportunity to partner up with Mandy Scheffel and the Red Spotted Newt in Hazard to put together a program to launch Willie's book in Hazard, since it's based there. The story is based in Hazard.
Okay, and I know that you have something new that you're calling cross-county collaborations. How does that work?
This has kind of been the backbone of all the things that we've been doing with our grant program, to get out and partner with local organizations around Kentucky and then link them up in some kind of way so that they're talking to each other about writing and literary things. And hopefully that'll spawn some more activity. It's just seemed like everyone's kind of set in their own ways and they're doing their own thing. And we want to mix it up a little bit. So we take our book award winner around the state and we bring young people from one place to another place. And it's working quite well, and it'll take some time to catch hold, but we're very pleased with it these couple of years.
Leaving the page and going to the screen, I know that you have some film screenings on the calendar for Lexington and Paducah, and they involve documentaries by Laura Dunn. Who is Laura, and what will we see?
Laura is an independent filmmaker who has spent the better part of a decade making films about Wendell Berry and his thoughts and life in Henry County, a person we know all very well. And her feature film won an award at the Sundance Festival, and the executive producer was Robert Redford for her original film, which was called Look and See, A Portrait of Wendell Berry. What we're screening are the series of shorts that she made after the feature film, which were the outtakes from her feature film that she just couldn't leave sitting on the cutting floor, as she said. And she made a series of short films that explore all kinds of aspects of Wendell's writing and philosophy and life, and actually has a segment done with his wife, Tanya, as well. And the reason that we're involved is that she used many, many, many of my father's pictures of Wendell and of natural Kentucky, because Wendell did not want to appear on camera during these shows. So she used my father's photographs as the visual mechanism to document the stories that she was telling. So that's kind of how we come into the story of screening films, which is obviously not exactly down our main pipeline, but Mary Berry is coming with us to give a little presentation on the state of agriculture in Kentucky and in the country as well. I think that should be an interesting Q&A session that will follow each screening.
And again, these screenings are in Lexington and Paducah. What theaters and dates and times?
In Lexington on April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Kentucky, and tickets will be available on the Kentucky Theater website. So that's again April 14th, 7 p.m. at the Kentucky. And then in Paducah 2 days later, April 16th, 7 p.m. at Maiden Alley, the cinema out in Paducah. We had made a lot of friends out there last year when we took the book award program out there and used that as an opportunity to bring this show to Paducah as well, to reinforce our friends there and make some more friends.
Okay, and for somebody that maybe just joined us or wants to dig in a little bit more, how can they find the foundation online?
Yes, jamesbakerhallfoundation.org is our website. All these events are there, as well as lots of information about who we are and what we're doing.
All right, that's Larry Pembo. He heads the James Baker Hall Foundation. Thank you so much, Larry.
Tom, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Theater contributor Bill McCann is here with Jordan Campbell, executive director of the Gateway Regional Arts Center at Mount Sterling. They have a sweet story to tell.
So, Jordan, you're directing Kat Gogan's The Sweet Life, The Ruth Hunt Story, as part of Actors Theater of Louisville's Storytelling Revolution. Tell us about that. How did you become involved first with the play and then with Actors Theater?
A couple of years ago, I started by applying for a National Endowment for the Arts grant. And so, you know, for a long time as a resident of Mount Sterling, born and raised here, moved away to New York for a while and did theater and then moved to DC for a while and did some policy things there, arts education related things. And then I came home and, you know, I always felt that the story of Ruth Hunt, not just the company that still exists, but the story of this woman in 1921 who had barely received the right to vote, let alone start a business. She started this empire, you know, of what we now know as Ruth Hunt Candies, which is known globally. So I always felt that the story was under-recognized. It's such a fascinating narrative. It's so important for small businesses in local communities that last for many generations. It's a really fascinating family legacy and how that sort of played out here in Mount Sterling. And so I just felt it was a great story and we needed to capture that history. So it was a two-part project that we were approved for through this National Endowment for the Arts grant. The first part was an oral history and capturing the stories of the people who made this a reality. So we did that first. Anna Klein is a resident of Mount Sterling. She's a historian and a musician. And she joined our team to sort of conduct those interviews with people close to the company, close to the story, friends of Ruth Hunt and her daughter, Emily Tillman Peck. So we wanted the full story before we looked at it artistically. So then the second phase was the playwriting portion. I felt from early on as well when I was applying for this grant that there are many art forms that we could sort of share this story with the world, but the best one, in my opinion, would be through theater and putting it live on stage, sort of bringing history to life. And so we did just that. We had a playwriting competition. We had several entries from all around the country, many from Kentucky. And then we selected five finalists. And from those five, we had each of those finalists write two scenes from their proposed, you know, play within the world that we had kind of given them the freedom to do. And then we selected our winner, which was Kat Gogan from Barberville, Kentucky. And her story just spoke so much to the strength of these women in this family, and what a transitional, you know, storyline from 1921 to today, where this company has gone through so many phases and is still around and is still abiding by those standards that Ruth Tharp Hunt put together in 1921, high quality candy. Yeah. So that's sort of how we happened upon this process.
Well, how did you become the director?
I sort of selected myself. You know, I had sort of served as project manager through the first half, you know, from the writing of the grant to the oral history to all the different elements, bringing together Larry Kiesel and Toby Moore, the current owners, the family, the grandchildren of Ruth Hunt are still with us. And so, you know, I had sort of pieced all this together and I felt as a theater maker, it was sort of my calling to see the project through and sort of make sure that the vision matched what the family wanted, what the story deserved, how it deserved to be told. So we worked really closely with Kat, our playwright, and Anna, who is our historian and had all these records and documentation. And we wanted to bring that story to life in a true, honest, authentic way through theater. So I am actually friends from way back with Amelia Acosta Powell, who is the artistic director at Actors Theater of Louisville. And Amelia and I were talking actually at Kentucky Arts Day at the Capitol in Frankfurt, and reminiscing. And I sort of said, you know, I saw that you guys are doing a play festival, and you really, you know, you're sort of leaning into local stories, Kentucky stories, Kentucky playwrights, you know, as much as you can. And well, do I have the perfect play for you? And so I submitted it and it was accepted, and they have been wonderful to work with. And we have our show on April 4th.
Okay, so this is basically a fringe type festival.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, so it's a one performance. It's a one show gig. And it's a part of a suite of several different plays that will be available, and people can go on the website and purchase packages for tickets. You can get sort of, if you want to see a certain number of shows, or really the hope is that people will come and engage with lots of different plays. And you can sort of just stick around and see the next show, or go for a whole weekend and see lots of different shows. So I'm just so excited that this truly Kentucky story, and a story that a lot of people don't know, they've had the candy, they've had Blue Monday, or they've had the bourbon balls, or they've had, you know, the Woodford Reserve bourbon balls, or whatever other candy that Ruth Hunt makes, the Meltaways, the ALH suckers. But they don't know the story behind it. And it's such a compelling story. And so we're excited to bring that to a wider audience in Louisville. And who knows, maybe there's a future beyond that on a national stage. We've been talking to some folks in New York, and there might be a life for it on a national stage.
Wonderful. So they can get their tickets by going to Actors Theater's website, is that correct? Or is there another way?
Yes, actorstheater.org is where to find tickets. And if you go to the Storytelling Revolution Festival page, The Sweet Life is on that list of shows. So we'd love for a lot of folks to come out on April 4th, especially from Central Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky, to see this show in all its glory.
Great. Well, thank you, Jordan Campbell, Executive Director of the Gateway Regional Arts Center, for being here today and talking about The Sweet Life.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org and check out our contributors and their interview archives. Shoot an email to us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.